Okay, welcome everyone. So let's continue on this exciting sutta, the Mahapanibbana Sutta. Somebody asked on Friday, are we going to finish it today? It's going to go on for a long time, right? So 2020 or thereabouts, maybe. We'll see how we go. But it's a very nice sutta, and one of the reasons why it is so nice is because it kind of summarizes the teachings of the Buddha. It gives you a very clarity about what is the essence of the teachings, what was really important to the Buddha, how he saw it moving into the future. And this, I think, is very interesting because it gives an overview, it gives a kind of general understanding of what is going on, which is very useful. And some of those things we're going to see today. So if I am right, we have reached that paragraph that we have got on the screen there, which says, past paragraph 112. I think we did the six things that are conducive to communal living last time, and now we've gotten there. Is that right? Yeah? Yeah, okay, great. So, okay, excellent. The problem is I'm doing this sutta at the monastery as well, in parallel with the monks, so I'm at different stages, at different places. It makes it really confusing for me after a while. That's one of the problems here. So that is the background. We're looking at how the Buddha is looking at the Dhamma from an overview kind of perspective. So this is kind of what is exciting about this, and also how the Dhamma then gets preserved into the future, right? So what are the essential aspects of the Dhamma? What are the things that are really important to memorize and to bring to future generations? Let's see what happens next then in the sutta. So far, he has met with the Brahmin called Vasakara, and Vasakara asked the Buddha, very interestingly, how to attack the Vajjayans. Right? It's a kind of unusual request probably for the Buddha to be asked, how exactly do we destroy these Vajjayans? And then the Buddha replies by actually telling this Vasakara, what are the qualities that make the Vajjayans strong? So he's probably trying to say, well, maybe you shouldn't attack them, right? They're very strong, etc. So he tells them all these qualities that lead to harmony. And then he goes on after that and applying the similar kind of qualities to what leads to harmony within the Sangha, within Buddhism. So it keeps Buddhism going for a long time into the future. And there's a large number of sets of qualities that lead to that. And then now we are kind of moving on to the next stage of the sutta after he's finished saying all of these things. Please, yes, yeah.
I find it a bit interesting what you have just summarized, yeah. You know, because you said, you know, essentially I believe from what I read is that the Buddha was saying you have no hope if you try to just conquer by arms.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what that means, perhaps with his ID or with his analysis that in terms of, you know, your strategy or your formation or whatever, you simply just can't. I mean, as a Chinese, I know how all the warfare and so on, history, you know, you just can't win, you know, for example. But, if you were to try to, you know, infiltrate or just cause sow discord and so on, that's how that can be done, you know, in the text.
Yeah.
I find it, I mean, how do I read that?
I suspect that what the Buddha is saying is that, you know, the Vajjayans, they are really strong. It's kind of they have got all these good qualities. I taught them these good qualities. I think the implication is that no need to invade them, right? It's going to be too problematic for you. They're a strong federation. So I think he's saying these qualities not to give him a hint for how to attack them, but more as a sense of trying to dissuade them. These are the qualities that they have. Maybe you should actually have the same qualities, right? Live in harmony, living well together. I think it's more a hint at not attacking rather than attacking.
I'm not sure if King Ajatasattu got the wrong side.
He got completely the wrong end of the stick. So straight away, after the Buddha has said that, then the general Vasakara, he says, the only way we can win them is by internal dissension, this kind of stuff. We have to kind of attack them in a different way. But that's it's the worldly side versus the Dhamma side, right? The worldly side takes even the Dhamma, it takes it and distorts it and uses it for worldly ends so as to, you know.
So I see that even the distorted understanding of the Dhamma can be very powerful.
Powerful in the worldly sense, but not
exactly. It came from the Buddha.
Yeah, yeah. So, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, I was always wondering about that passage myself, but I think that's probably a reasonable way of understanding it, actually. Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. So now we paragraph 112, and this is what the sutta says. So this is all narrative part. It's not really the Buddha speaking. This is the narrative aspect here. Huh? And then the Lord, while staying at Vulture's Peak, gave a comprehensive discourse. This is morality. This is stillness. This is wisdom. Stillness, when imbued with morality, brings great fruit and profit. Wisdom, when imbued with stillness, brings great fruit and profit. The mind imbued with wisdom becomes completely free from the corruptions. That is the corruption of sensuality, of becoming or of being, of false views and of ignorance. So, again, sometimes one has to be a little bit careful with the translation here. It's only minor points, but it says a comprehensive discourse. And really what the Pali says is many, many Dhamma talks. He gives many Dhamma talks. And you can see, so that what follows after that, after many Dhamma talks, is then the essence of what those Dhamma talks are all about, right? So they're about this triad of morality, stillness, and wisdom. And of course, this is a summary of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? Noble Eightfold Path has to do with morality. Then you move on to stillness. Then you move on to wisdom. So it's a summary, another summary, way of summarizing the path of practice, in a sense. And then it says, and this is kind of the interesting part here, that when stillness is imbued with morality, it brings great fruit and great wisdom, right? When samadhi is, the word imbued here means like penetrated with or suffused with or filled with the idea of morality. Morality here, of course, is sila, right? So the idea of filling it with or imbuing it with means as much as possible, right? It doesn't just mean we keep the five precepts or we maybe keep the eight precepts on certain Upasana days or whatever. What it means is that we take morality as far as possible. And that means we're imbuing the samadhi, imbuing the meditation with enough power to make us reach whatever stage we want to reach. And I think this is very important, because very often when we think about meditation practice, we think about things such as what is the right meditation object, what is the special technique that we'll be using to observe this object, how long should we be sitting for. You get all these questions about meditation practice, but really, if you want your meditation to work, there is really one foundation that makes meditation work, and that is always sila. Sila is a thing which is repeated everywhere in the sutta as the foundation for meditation practice. And so it is here, right? It's this that really matters. So we need to be really kind of almost like brutally honest with ourselves and see, well, where are we still lacking? This doesn't mean that we should be fault-finding with ourselves and harsh on ourselves. We should still rejoice at all the good things we're doing. But we need to take it one step further. What can I do even better, right? And this, in other words, and of course, in these cases, the idea of mental purity becomes very important for meditation to work. It's very hard to have a still mind if you are being obsessed by desires and anger, because these things, by their very nature, are restless. By their very nature, they move you into the future and the past. And it's very hard to meditate on that basis. So it's a very, very, very important statement, this idea that virtue, sila, morality, character, habits, who we are as people, this is what in the end either enables or disables the meditation practice. So I think this is something people tend to pass over too lightly, but actually it is so important for the whole process. And so that is the first aspect here. And then the second one is that it is wisdom that is imbued, right, or suffused or filled with samadhi here, right? That is what brings great fruit and benefit. In other words, again, this thing that you see so many places in the suttas, that it is samadhi that is the basis for wisdom. In fact, wisdom and samadhi always go together. They're two sides of the same coin, two sides of the same knife, if you like. It was a simile used by Ajahn Chah, I think. So this, again, this importance of meditation and stillness of the mind for true wisdom to arise. It is something, once you start reading the suttas, you see it everywhere. It's absolutely, you know, it's something you can't really miss. And yet, somehow, people, you know, this is something that is often forgotten in meditation circles around the world. This connection between samadhi and wisdom, wisdom and samadhi, so significant and so important. So, and again here you can see that, of course, samadhi itself often tends to be a very automatic thing. And then if you have the right view, the right understanding of how things work, then that samadhi will tend to lead to wisdom also fairly automatically. So it is the virtue, it is the habits, the character we have. That is really where all the work is to be done. That is where and it's also quite hard, right? It's hard to change our habits. But that is what we need to do, essentially, to make this whole sequence just work out quite naturally. Yeah? And then, when that wisdom, the mind imbued with wisdom, what happens to that mind? It is completely freed from these corruptions, the asavas, right? These root defilements of the mind that are often the kind of the very basis, the very most basic things that tie us to the round of existence, tie us to samsara. And it is interesting, if you look at these three asavas, sensuality here, becoming is the bhava asava, which I would translate as existence, and then false views it has, and then, which is ditti and ignorance, avijja, of course. The first thing to point out is that the Mahapanibbana Sutta is one of the few places where you have false views added to the asavas. Usually you only have three asavas. False views is out, so you just have sensuality, existence and ignorance. But here you have the fourth one coming in. In fact, in some versions of this sutta, there is no false views. All there is the three other ones. So they seem to be the original ones. And I think we can leave aside false views for now. So when you are left with the three other ones, what you see when you look at those is that they are very similar to the three types of craving that lead to suffering, right? Second noble truth, what are the three types of craving? Kama tanha, bhava tanha, and vibhava tanha. Here we have kama asava, bhava asava, and avijja asava. So tanha and asava are here. They are kind of interchangeable, and the other three are actually very similar to each other. Sensuality, existence. The biggest difference is that for the three types of craving, you have the vibhavatana, which means like desire or craving for extermination or non-existence. Here instead we have the avijja-asava. But those two are actually quite closely connected to each other, because the idea of annihilation, right, or wanting to exterminate yourself, it means that you have an idea that there is too much suffering in the world. You don't want to exist anymore, you'd like to commit suicide, right? And of course that comes from the problem that we don't really understand the nature of the five khandhas. We don't understand the nature that these things are empty of the self. We don't understand that there's actually nothing to be destroyed. There's nothing there to be annihilated. It's just a process, and that process goes according to certain conditions and causes. Take those away, and the process stops all by itself. And of course, that is like avijja, right? Avijja is ignorance, and of course, ignorance at the deepest level is, again, very similar to that. It's about not understanding the nature of the five khandhas, not understanding the emptiness, that there is a lack of no self there, the impermanence and the suffering and all that. So these things are also very closely related to each other, the vibhava tanha and the avijja-asava. So this is very closely related to that. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because the three root defilements that keep existence going are ended at this particular stage, which is very similar to the ending of craving that we see in the second noble truth or the third noble truth. And then, of course, you end the future existence as a consequence. So a close connection there between those two sets of factors. Here, the word asava is translated as corruption, and I think that is probably quite a good translation, as corruption of the mind. And sometimes it is speculated whether it means outflowing and all this kind of stuff, but I think corruption is quite a suitable translation in this context. So that is what you have to do, right? It's fairly straightforward. Live well, get into the meditation, then allow the wisdom to arise based on the teachings of the Buddha, and then end these corruptions, and then you are happy. That's basically what it says. Sounds good, doesn't it? So that's the path. Summarized very briefly. And of course, that was kind of the point I was saying before. I was trying to make is that these are the summaries the Buddha is making of what is really important on the path. So here you get, this is actually kind of boils it down to some of the essential qualities. We're going to see that this particular formula here, it is being repeated in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, because remember now the Buddha is, just after this, he will start on his last journey, which goes all the way to Kushinara, where he passes away, and every place he stops on the way, he gives this teaching. It isn't so much that he gives this teaching, but this is the summary of pretty much any teaching the Buddha gives. It's the kind of the pragmatic path to Nibbana that he's talking about. This is how you summarize it. And when the Lord had stayed at Rajagaha as long as he wished, he said to Venerable Ananda, "Come, Ananda, let us go to Ambalatika." "Very good, Lord," said Ananda, and the Lord went there with a large company of monks. So now the Buddha is setting out, right, from Rajagaha. Rajagaha was one of the main places where he stayed. The most important one was Sabati, and Rajagaha would have been one of the other great places where he stayed a lot. And he sets out on his last journey, and this is kind of the first leg, if you like, on that last journey, setting out. And the first place they go to is Ambalatika. Now what happens there is as follows. And the Lord stayed in the royal park, or the royal house at Ambalatika, and there he delivered many discourses. This is morality, this is stillness, this is wisdom, etc., exactly as before. Having stayed at Ambalatika as long as he wished, the Lord said to Ananda, "Let us go to Nalanda," and they did so. At Nalanda, the Lord stayed at Pavarika's mango grove. So here we are reminded of the various places where the Buddha is going. So perhaps this is a historical record of what the Buddha actually did on his last journey. It is hard to really know. It is kind of curious, right? He goes to Ambalatika and he just says exactly the same thing there as he said when he was in Rajagaha. There's not a single word difference. Exactly the same thing. So you almost wonder, why is it included, this stopover at Ambalatika? It's only this tiny little place, Ambalatika. It is where he gave the Ambalatika Rahulavada Sutta, the exhortation to Rahula, his son, right, at Ambalatika. But it's a very kind of, it's a very minor place according to the suttas. So why is it even mentioned? And it is not entirely clear why that is the case, but I suspect that it may have to do with the monks. Remember, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta was obviously composed or put together after the Buddha passed away. It's all really narrative. It wasn't the Buddha who composed the sutta. Some of the sayings are probably from the Buddha, right? But the overall thing obviously comes from somebody else, because it's all narrative. So it would have happened maybe at the first council, or maybe later, or something like that. So it could be that the reason why all these things are mentioned is because those people who put it together, they wanted to make the point, right, that the Buddha is now going to all of these places, and everywhere there are disciples, everywhere there are people listening to the Buddha's teachings. So he has like disciples everywhere. Buddhism is becoming strong in India. And of course, it is a nice thing to advertise, right, that things are going well, things, kind of the Dhamma is prospering here, and this sort of thing here. So that might be what is going on there. So we have to kind of understand the context a little bit to see what's happening possibly here. And then he has exactly the same teaching there, and then he goes to Nalanda. Right? And then when he gets to Nalanda, then he goes to the Pavarika's mango grove. And then the Venerable Sariputta came to see the Lord, saluted him, and sat down to one side. So, salutere is a word which probably means something like bow down to. It's probably more correct. Salute is a little bit kind of ambiguous, not entirely clear what that would mean. So Venerable Sariputta comes to meet him when it comes to Nalanda. And there's a very close connection between Venerable Sariputta and Nalanda. This was probably where he was born. And in his old age, he goes back to Nalanda and to visit his family, etc. His mother was visiting there. There is a late story about Venerable Sariputta his mother getting converted towards the very end of his life. It's a kind of a nice little story. I don't know how much trust to put into that story. It's kind of a bit over the top, but I'm not going to tell it now. But there is a nice story there. So if you want to read about those stories, a good place to go is The Great Disciples of the Buddha, one of the books that we have in the library over here. But what is interesting is this connection between Nalanda and Venerable Sariputta, right? There's obviously a strong connection there. And this is why we see that connection also here in this particular case. Of course, Nalanda in later years became the great university at Nalanda, right? Those of you who have been to India, you've probably seen those remarkable ruins there, very, very large ruins at Nalanda. And they say that only a tiny fraction of the area has been excavated. And yet, despite only a tiny fraction, the ruins you see up pretty impressive already. It's pretty kind of these enormous brick buildings, these tiny, lots of these little cells inside where monks were probably living and studying and all these things. Brick walls, the kind of meter thick, right? Very impressive buildings that you see there. You get this feeling for this enormous place of learning until it was destroyed in the 12th and 13th century by the invaders into India. And burnt up, monks were killed, etc., and everything was kind of destroyed at that time. But it's fascinating. I think the obvious reason why it was built at Nalanda, I think one possible reason anyway, is of course that Venerable Sariputta was from there. So he was the chief of the Buddha's disciples, the one who was most famous for his wisdom, right? So it would be natural in a sense to build perhaps a university in a place like that, where the chief disciple was known for his connection with that place. And I suspect that might be a reason why it was built on that spot. But the irony, and this is kind of the interesting thing about this, is of course that Venerable Sariputta, he was wise in an experiential sense. He had understood the Dhamma personally. He had destroyed the defilements. He had practiced the path to its end. But a university is not really about experiencing things. Universities are more about worldly learning, more about kind of hierarchies and positions and being the professor and having as much knowledge as possible, right? It is much more a worldly direction than a spiritual direction that you find in a monastery or you find in somebody who's practicing the Dhamma. So the irony is that here we have the most accomplished of all the disciples of the Buddha. He's like almost like lending his name to the place because it is connected with him somehow. And yet the whole place goes in a completely different direction, in a much more worldly direction that has to do with all these other things that are, you know, considered status symbols, if you like, in the worldly sense. And Nalanda was incredibly famous in those days. All some of the greatest scholars of Buddhism were there, right? People like Vasubandhu and some of the great scholars that came, especially after the 5th century AD. Some of the most famous of the Chinese pilgrims came all the way from China and they studied at Nalanda University for many years. Shuang Tsang, one of the most famous of all the pilgrims, he stayed there for a number of years apparently. So you can see it was an international famous institution already in those days. But it went slightly in the wrong direction, which is what you would expect of universities, becoming more an intellectual bastion, a place of learning, a place of debate, a place of kind of almost like academic one-upmanship, right? That's what you kind of expect of some of these universities. And of course, that doesn't really take you in the right direction. And sometimes when I look at the Buddhist world today, you can see similar things happening in the Buddhist world today. So many universities in the Buddhist world, you know, the great Buddhist universities in places like Thailand, in Burma, in Sri Lanka, And these are kind of often some of the most exalted places of Buddhism, rather than perhaps the place where the Buddhism is practiced. And if you look at some of the things happening around the world, people want to restart Nalanda University in India, right, to bring it back to its former glory. But perhaps what they should instead is plant a few trees and have a forest monastery, right? That would be, I think, an even better way of kind of, you know, doing something to the old name of Nalanda, rather than actually building up a university there. But the world, you know, people tend to think in worldly ways. This is kind of the basis of things. We tend to think about status from a worldly perspective, and that is why we tend to, I think, move in that direction. And we tend often to get the wrong message from these things. But I would, you know, personally, I think, yes, there can be some good coming out of universities, but I think often there's more negative things than there is good things, more of the kind of usual stuff of seeking status in the wrong place with the wrong things. Anyways, that's just a little bit of history about Nalanda and what happened there. And when the Buddha went to this particular place. Yes, please.
If I'm not wrong, Nalanda is a bit south, right?
It is north of Rajagaha, so it's on the way north when you walk from Rajagaha.
Okay.
So on the way to Pataliputra, to Patna, to the Ganges River here. The Buddha's walking north now here.
Okay, so it's still quite a big walk, right?
It's probably about 30 kilometers, something like that. So that's probably why he stopped at Ambalatika on the way. And there may have been other stops as well, presumably. So, yeah.
Because at the time he was 80 years old.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So probably would have been walking not too fast. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Okay, maybe he was staying in certain forest groves on the way as well, right? Maybe he was stopping in a forest grove for the night. But they're not mentioned. All they mention is the towns and the cities. Forgotten about all the forest groves. That would have been more inspiring, wouldn't it? And he stopped in a forest grove, stayed there for a couple of days, just meditating with the monks. That's kind of passed over in silence. All the important stuff isn't there, right? This is typical of history. Yeah, exactly. This is the problem with history. All it remembers is the battles and the big things and the kind of power-hungry people and that sort of stuff. So that's what kind of sort of happens. Okay. So then what happens then is the next thing here. What happens in this meeting between Venerable Sariputta and the Buddha? So he sits down to one side and said, "It is clear to me, Lord, that there never has been, will be, or is now another ascetic or Brahmin who is better or more awakened than the Lord." Right? So this is the first thing that he says. Of course, Venerable Sariputta, being the wisest disciple of the Buddha, he knows what he is talking about. And I think this very first statement here is also already a little bit interesting, because it points to the idea that the Buddha, he has taken the human condition or the humanity to its highest potential. There isn't anything beyond that. You can't become even more awakened or know even more about the nature of reality here. You can perhaps have more knowledge about certain things, perhaps. I mean, I'm sure there are things the Buddha wouldn't have known about. But in terms of awakening, in terms of real wisdom and understanding the human condition, it's impossible to go beyond that. And of course, that's important, right? Because it means that sometimes you hear claims of people who are, you know, they have found kind of what even higher beyond the Buddha. You hear about things like the Adi Buddha is kind of the Buddha beyond the Buddha, right? And all of these claims of somebody who claims to be even higher or beyond these things. But from a Buddhist point of view, this is really how far it's possible to go as a human being. You have taken human wisdom and human understanding to its maximum limit. So I think that's an important statement in its own right, just to know that this is the limit. And of course, an arahant like Venerable Sariputta or like any other arahant in the world, they will have reached the same level of awakening, the same level of understanding as the Buddha himself. So they will also be at that particular level. And I guess one of the reasons Venerable Sariputta is saying that is precisely because there was always some sense of conflict or some sense of who is better among the different religions at that time, just as there is today. And so he's just saying that this is the maximum level that you can go to. And the Buddha replies, "You have spoken boldly with a bull's voice, Sariputta. You have roared the lion's roar of certainty. How is this? How is this? Have all the arahant Buddhas of the past appeared to you, and were the minds of all those lords open to you, so as to say, these lords were of such virtue, such was their teaching, such their wisdom, such their way, such their liberation? No, Lord." So, first we have this idea of the lion's roar, right? The bull's voice, the lion's roar. These were like the king of beasts at the time in India. It was interesting, I was in Africa recently, and when we went out one evening, we could hear a lion roar far in the distance. And it was a bit kind of, bit like this. You could hear this mighty roar up in the mountains many kilometers away. And that was kind of the lion's roar. And of course, it's kind of asserting your authority, right, over a certain area, asserting who is really the boss here. So this is kind of the idea behind the lion's roar here. Somebody who, you know, makes an assertion of certainty, for which there, you know, everybody, there is no doubt in a sense. And the Buddha asks him, have you known the qualities of these ancient Buddhas in the past? Such was their virtue. Such was their teaching. Dhamma here actually means more like quality. Such was their qualities. And qualities very often refers to things like samadhi. The word is dhamma here. So such was their samadhi. Such was their meditation practice, in other words. Right? They had such virtue, such meditation, such wisdom, such their way. This is the vihari, evang vihari. And vihari is like in the sutta, it's like if you have a vihara, right, it's a place where a monastic will dwell, is a vihara. It's like a kuti or a house for monastics. So it has the further meaning of a particular way of dwelling, a particular way of being. So it often refers either to samadhi itself, the immaterial attainments or whatever it is, or it can refer to the various stages of awakening. You dwell as a stream enter, you dwell as a once returner, etc. What is their dwelling? It means what is their state of achievement on the Buddhist path. That's really what it refers to there. And the last one, such is their liberation. No, Lord. So, sutta here says, were all those, the minds of all those lords open to you, what it means really, have you read their mind? That's actually what it means. Cheto pariyayanyana is the knowledge of the reading of other people's minds. So have you actually read the minds of all those arahants in the past, right? This is what he's saying here. And he says, no, I haven't done that. Venerable Sariputta was not famous for his psychic powers. He was famous for his wisdom, for his understanding, for the overcoming of the defilements, and for his ability to enter deep samadhi. That's what he was famous for, not for his psychic powers. In fact, he is said to have no psychic powers. There is a little sutta in the, what is it again, in the Sanyutta Nikaya, I think it's in the Yakka Sanyutta, something like that. And Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Mahamoggallana, they are together, and they're sitting there. And while they're sitting there, this Yakka is one of these ferocious demons, right? This is a kind of another story, narrative kind of story. Not really sure if it happened exactly this way, but that's the story. And this demon comes, and it gives Venerable Sariputta a mighty whack on the head. I think these days they call it to king hit somebody. Isn't that what they call it when somebody does something in Northbridge at night? And on Friday night, the king hits somebody and they kind of knock them out and they're really in bad shape afterwards. It's a terrible thing to do. But here was this Yakka who was king hitting Venerable Sariputta in the old days. It's a kind of, maybe this is the origin of king hitting. It comes from this. And Venerable Sariputta, he's in deep meditation, right? So it comes out of his meditation, oh, I have a little bit of a headache. What happened? And then Moggallana tells him, well, actually, while you were sitting there, this demon came, right, and gave you a mighty whack over the head. It's a miracle you're still alive. And you say all you have is a little bit of a headache. How is that possible? And of course, because of the samadhi. And then Venerable Sariputta kind of praises Venerable Mahamoggallana in return. He says, wow, you can actually see these beings kind of traveling around and giving people wax on the head. I couldn't even see a mud goblin, he says, in this particular case, meaning he can't see anything. He doesn't have any psychic powers. That is what he's saying at that particular place. So it seems to have been the received wisdom, even from early on, that Venerable Sariputta didn't really have any special abilities in that area. He just had wisdom, right? Which of course is far more superior anyway. So it doesn't really make much difference. John?
Why did the Buddha say that anyway? Have you been reading the minds of arahants and Buddhas, that they don't exist anymore? So how could he read minds?
I don't know. I guess he would have gone back in past life memories and kind of remembered reading their minds in the past or something like that. I don't know. I'm not sure. But this is what maybe it's just a rhetorical question. Maybe he knows the answer already, right? A few possibilities there. Yeah? Yes, Min.
I noticed that in some parts of the passages there are numbers in square brackets. What does that mean?
Numbers in square brackets. Okay. That is the Pali text. Yeah, so the Pali text of the PTS, the Pali Text Society, it refers to the page numbers in that text. Yeah. Okay. What the Buddha is saying here, of course, and what is interesting, is basically he's asking Venerable Sariputta, how have you attained this knowledge? That's basically what he's saying here. And of course, the first way to ascertain how you attain knowledge in this world, and this is one of the most important ways in Buddhist practice as well, is by direct insight. You see something directly for yourself. This is number one way of attaining understanding. And very often in Buddhism, we think that that is the only way, your only way to understand yourself, the mind, the five khandhas, all of these kind of things, is through seeing things directly. And this is what he's asking, and this is why this is interesting, because Venerable Sariputta is saying, no, I haven't seen these things directly. So what are the alternative ways of achieving such an understanding? If you haven't seen it directly for yourself, then maybe you haven't seen anything at all. Some people might argue that. But in fact, and this is one of the... So then the Buddha about all the Buddhas in the future. Such is other qualities. Well then, Sariputta, do you know me as the Arahant Buddha, and do you know the Lord is of such virtue, such is his samadhi, such is his wisdom, such are his dwellings in terms of understanding, such his liberation. No, Lord. So here you can see that he can't even read the mind of someone at present, right? Let alone somebody in the past or the future. So, Sariputta, you do not have knowledge of the minds of the Buddhas of the past, present, or the future. Thus, Sariputta, have you not spoken boldly with a bull's voice and roared a lion's roar of certainty with your declaration? And he replies, Lord, the minds of the Arahant Buddhas of the past, future, and present are not open to me, but I know the drift of the Dhamma. This is called Dham Anvaya in Pali. And Anvaya, the word Anvaya, means literally to kind of move along with or to go along with. And the idea here is really very similar to the English idea of inference. Right? You deduce something. You use inference to come to a conclusion. You see certain patterns. You see certain things going in a certain way. Certain things, certain natural laws. I infer that that's a mobile phone ringing at the back. And when I hear that sound, I don't know, but I infer, right? Same kind of thing. I apologize. I don't mean to embarrass anyone. So you have inference. And this is really, I think, the best translation of the word Dham Anvaya. inference according to Dhamma. You infer because you understand how the laws of the Dhamma work. You understand the law of dependent origination, one thing being the cause, being the condition for something else. And when you understand a kind of the laws of the mind, the laws of the five khandhas, the laws of how things, then you can come to certain conclusions without actually seeing the things for yourself. Right? And this is what this is really, this is pointing to here. I understand how this whole system works, and that is why I can say these things. And so, and then he gives an example, right, of this idea of inference. Lord, it is as if there were a royal frontier city with mighty bastions and a mighty encircling wall in which was a single gate, at which was a gatekeeper, wise, skilled and clever, who kept out strangers and let in those he knew. And he, constantly patrolling and following along a path, might not see the joins or clefts in the bastion, even such as a cat might creep through. But whatever larger creatures entered or left the city must all go through this very gate. Right? So the idea here is that you don't actually know. There's a city. It has a large wall around it. It only has one entrance. You don't know how all those people in the city or all the animals in the city, you don't know how they got in there. But you can infer by walking around the perimeter. You are seeing no gaps that are large enough to allow anyone to get in. From that, you can infer, you can deduce that the only way they got in was through the main gate. Right? You know that through inference, not by direct observation, but by inferring what is going on. You understand the laws that govern this particular city. And of course, the idea here with this city is that entering the city is like reaching awakening, right? And there is only one entrance to that awakening. And once you understand what that entrance is, you know that everybody who got there must have passed through on that same path to get there. And that is what he says next. This is how he then explains this particular simile. And it seems to me, Lord, that the drift or the inference according to Dhamma is the same. All those Arahant Buddhas of the past attained to supreme awakening by abandoning the five hindrances, defilements of the mind that weaken understanding, having established the four applications of mindfulness in their minds and realized the seven factors of awakening as they really are. Right? And then the same for the Arahant Buddhas of the future and the Arahant Buddhas of the past. So you know that this is the only way to achieve awakening. There is no other path. And that path leads to one destination, because Venerable Sariputta has himself traveled to that destination. He knows where that path leads, and it leads to arahantship. This is the only way that this goes. This is the only result of practicing that path. And there isn't really any alternative results from this. So this is one of the interesting things, in a sense, about Buddhism, is that there is not just knowledge according to direct insight and direct understanding and seeing things immediately, but there's also certain knowledge that arises through inference, through understanding the broader legal implications, if you like, the framework, the laws that govern the mind and govern samsara and govern existence. And then you can actually come to certain conclusions based on that. And I think it is important to realize that, because it has quite a few implications for how we understand the Dhamma. These are the kind of questions that often come up when you have Dhamma discussions. Sometimes I take part in Dhamma discussions on the internet and that kind of thing. And of course, you see what kind of discussions are going on. Sometimes I get long letters about people, explaining their understanding of Dhamma and these kind of things. One of the problems, for example, I'll give you an example of how this works, is how do we understand the idea of rebirth, right? Now, many people would say the only way you can understand rebirth is by experiencing it yourself. And of course, the only way you can experience it yourself in this life would be to remember your past lives. That's really the only way. You can't really see the future, so it has to be about the past lives. So they say that, you know, the only way that you can understand dependent origination is by remembering your past lives, understanding how craving kind of drives you across the boundary between lives, and then you understand the connection between craving and rebirth. Right? But I say, and this is what this is all about, the dhammanvaya, the inference according to Dhamma. You don't actually need that, because all you really need to do is to understand the causal relationship between craving on the one hand and then rebirth or continuation of the mind on the other. And that causal relationship is actually quite simple. In many ways, you can see it already in this very life. And that is the fact that as long as you crave, it's almost as if you're projecting yourself into the future. The mind is never really in the present moment, right? There's always this preoccupation with the future. And that projection, in a sense, is what then drives you on, even in this life. But also, you understand, and this is what the insight of that dhammanvaya is all about, you understand that that projection into the future does not stop just because you die. Death is not an absolute boundary, an absolute end to this projection into the future. It actually has to continue after that. Because the mind is still there, and the mind then carries on. The mind is still propelled by this force of craving that drives you forward into a new life, into a new existence. So this is what inference means, understanding the broader picture of things, understanding certain laws of cause and effect. And when you understand those laws of cause and effect, then you can make inferences on that basis. Another example which comes to mind is quite a famous, or maybe not that famous, but it's a simile found elsewhere in the suttas, in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the connected discourses of the Buddha. And in this particular simile, there is one monk who says that he has, what has he understood? I think he has says he has understood dependent origination. Yeah, it must be that, because it's in the Nidana Samyutta. So he says, I have understood dependent origination. And then this other monk says to him, well, that must mean that you are an arahant. And he says, no, it is not that I'm an arahant. And then he gives him this simile to explain the difference, right, between not being an arahant and having understood the Dhamma and actually being an arahant and having realized the Dhamma. And the difference is, he says, it's like when you come to a well. You come to a well, you look into the well, you can see the water at the bottom. Right? You look down, you can see the water. You haven't tasted the water yet, but you know where it is. Not only do you know where it is, you know the path to get there. The path to get there is down the well, right? It's a very simple one-way path. So you know about the Dhamma. You know what Nibbana actually is when you become a stream enter. You understand that the path you are practicing must lead to that Nibbana, which is the ending of all defilements and the ending of all suffering. You understand what all these things actually mean, but you haven't actually reach the point an arahant, a fully awakened being. That's when you drink the water. Drinking the water means the abandoning of the defilements and the abandoning of suffering when you become an arahant. So that is the difference again. And you can see that is very similar to the idea of dependent arising, that you what you are seeing, you have an inferential understanding that this path must lead to final awakening. You can see how all the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, how they purify your mind, and when the mind then is entirely pure, then you enter samadhi, right? And with that power of the samadhi, that is when awakening is attained. You know that because you have already practiced that to a very large extent, to the point where you have seen the Dhamma. You have seen how the whole thing fits together, how all the different bits of the jigsaw puzzle called the path fit together. You've seen that, so you understand the causality, the laws that operate in this particular context. So that is the importance of inference on the Buddhist path. And of course it goes beyond this as well into many areas, because a lot of these things are about causality, right? And the more you kind of contemplate these teachings, the more you see how these things work. Another interesting example of causality and inference is when you do things like Satipatthana practice, and you contemplate the feelings, right, the Vedananupassana. And when you contemplate the feelings, first of all, you do it with a reference to yourself. And you see how certain feelings disappear, other feelings arise. You see their impermanence, the shifting, and all of these kind of things. But then, at some stage, you want to make the shift, not just to contemplate your own five khandhas, but to contemplate the khandhas of other people as well, other people's feelings, right? How can you do that? Well, you might be able to read the mind, that's one possibility. But another way is just through inference. You know that other people behave roughly like you do, right? If they do something which is painful, they hit themselves, they say, ouch, right? Just like you say, ouch, when you hurt yourself. So because of that, you can infer that they have feelings just like you have. So you use that then to expand this idea of understanding the contemplation of feeling in a much broader way to include all beings. And eventually, that becomes a universal breakthrough where you understand that all beings have this nature. Right? Everyone has this nature. There's no escape from that. And of course, once you understand that, then you also what you understand as well is that it's not as if you can be reborn in a certain place and always experience happy feelings, or if you like, be reborn in a place and always experience negative feelings. These things are impossible because you understand the nature of feeling across the board. You have understood the whole gamut of feelings, and you know that they have a certain nature, a certain causal arising and passing away, and it's universal. There's no escape from that law that decides how feelings arise and pass away. Yes, please.
We're having a discussion about rebirth. And
okay.
Some people who say, well, I've never seen it.
Yeah.
Therefore, how can I really take that on? I have to wait. And I said, well, what about faith? I think Ajahn Brahma said you have to have a certain amount of faith.
Yeah.
But I said, with my own self, I found that how could anybody doubt it? When you study the Buddha's words and you keep seeing today what he said 2,500 years ago, that it's equivalent to today, whether it's euthanasia or anything like that, you see it clearly. So I say to myself, well, if I see all that is correct in my way of looking at it, why shouldn't we see rebirth as also that the Buddha has told us that, like the other thing? So what do you think about that? Is faith a certain amount?
Definitely. I think it's an extremely important part of it, you know. I think it's very important. If the Buddha says there is rebirth, why shouldn't we have a degree of faith in that? I mean, that's what being a Buddhist is all about, isn't it? Being a Buddhist is that you think the Buddha actually realized something, he saw certain things. Being a Buddhist means you take that seriously. Yes, if the Buddha said so, I've got to take it seriously. So, of course, faith is a very important part of this. You know, very often we talk about what this thing called anecdotal evidence of things. You hear somebody tells you a story, oh, I had this feeling, this out-of-body experience, and once I know that the mind can kind of become separate from the body, and from now on I believe in rebirth and all these kind of things. So anecdotal experience is, in many ways, very powerful, and very often science itself, it starts off with anecdotes. You hear a funny story, you investigate it scientifically, and then maybe you come to a new theory about things based on that evidence. But for me, the most important anecdotal evidence is the evidence that the Buddha said there is rebirth. The Buddha said, I have seen my own past life. Right? This is also an anecdotal evidence, really, because he's saying these things. And because the Buddha is the Buddha, you place a lot of confidence into that kind of anecdotes as being very powerful and very important. So, yeah, I fully agree with you on that. Yeah, very good. Yeah. Eddie, yeah.
Ajahn Brahmali, you know, I noticed this sutta,
The
Buddha was speaking to the monks, you know, not lay people, and following the footsteps, you know, okay, it leads to arahantship, to fully enlightenment. This sutta here?
Yeah.
We understand that, there's no doubt, okay, but for a lay person, we have to be true to ourselves, isn't it?
Yeah.
We can't fully say you're at stage 2, 3, 4, or 5, you can't jump to stage 10. For example, if a person still have, layperson, still have sensual desires, you know, you can't just suppress that, you know. As you said last night, you know, excellent talk, you know, like suppress that and become depressed, no. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
We have to sort of slowly
So your point is that that it is natural to have some doubt about rebirth. Is that your point?
No, not doubt. What I mean is, if you still have like desire, you know, this sutta here is the doctor and monks, you say like hindrances is desire.
Yeah.
But for a normal lay person who still have desire, So we have to truth ourselves. We have to have that little desire, isn't it?
Mm.
You see what I mean?
Yes, you have to be true to yourself.
Yeah,
yes,
and slowly, move along the path.
Yeah.
That's how it should be, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, slowly. Yeah, one step at a time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, but also, you know, on the point of rebirth, yes, it is of course true that we have faith because the Buddha said these things. But at the same time, we also recognize that faith is not the same thing as knowledge. We recognize that it is faith at this point, and hopefully one day we move on to knowledge. We keep a kind of a distinction between those two things there, I think, in mind is also useful. Because what is faith is not 100% certain, but whereas knowledge is 100% certain once you get there. Yeah. So, but also, Eddie, you know, the sutta here it is true, a lot of these things are talked to the monks, and in this particular case, it's between Venerable Sariputta and the Buddha, this particular one. So it's actually the Venerable Sariputta speaking to the Buddha. But many of these things are also taught to lay people. Not everything here is to the monks, and we'll see that later on. So there is a mixture, and that very often the Dhamma is the same, whether it is for lay people or for monastics. Remember that. It is just the emphasis that is slightly different. It might emphasize certain things because of commitment or whatever on the path, but the Dhamma is the same. So it should mesh very nicely with each other. It should kind of, it's not, there isn't any absolute difference between the two.
For lay people, It depends
so much, you know. Sometimes the monks and the nuns, I mean, there are very good monks and very, very good nuns, and there are monks and nuns that aren't so good. There are some lay people that are really astonishingly well practiced. There are other lay people who are not. It's just enormous variety. And sometimes you find lay people that, some of the best lay people are certainly much better than the bad monks, right? You find some really dodgy monks out there as well. So let's be honest about it. Not kind of pretending otherwise. So, and this is the way it is. So you have to kind of look in the right place. Yeah. Venerable Wayne, yeah. Yes.
Ajahn,
yeah.
This sutta, isn't Venerable Sariputta inferring that maybe this particular Lord Buddha Gautama might have more powers himself compared to other Buddhas, like maybe seeing past lives deeper or other abilities that a Buddha has, rather than just the last part of the sutta where he's talking about gaining enlightenment?
But he's inferring that the Buddha had more powers than previous Buddhas? I don't think so. I think he's just saying that they're all pretty much on the same level. I think that's what he's saying here. There's nobody actually more enlightened or more gone beyond that. I think he's saying that they're basically on the same level. I think that's what he's saying here. So he is saying that the Buddha is the best in a certain way, because if you can't go any higher, the Buddha is among that group of those who are best. So he's saying, you're the best. There's nobody better than you as well.
You wouldn't find certain Buddhas would have more in-depth knowledge, like ability to teach or...
Yeah.
Well,
true. No doubt there would be personal differences because people have personalities, right? So there would be personal differences. But that is kind of irrelevant. What is relevant is your understanding of the nature of existence. Yeah. All of the stuff is deep details. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Very good. So that is the that. Inference and based on natural law. And what is that natural law? That is this law of the Buddhist path, how to actually get from the beginning, get to the end. And that law is you abandon the five hindrances. Having abandoned those, and they are described here in quite a nice way, these are the defilements of the mind that weaken wisdom. Panya dubali karana, they make wisdom weak, quite literally is what it means. So as long as you have any of the five hindrances in your mind, you have a problem, you have a distortion, you have a weakness in the mind. The mind is not able to really penetrate and see things according to reality because of these hindrances. So you've got to get rid of them. And this is why so much of the path is about getting to the point where the hindrances are gone. Right, this is an aspect in many ways of morality. When we talk about morality, it is really that what it is about is about this reduction in the five hindrances, starting off with our physical actions and speech, moving on to the mind. Very nice little sutta which I talk about sometimes is the sutta which says that there are two powers that people can use, and one of those powers is called the Patisankhana Bala. Patisankhana means reflection or contemplation. So the power of reflection, right? That's one power. The other power is the bhavana bala. Bhavana is like development of the mind, right? So these are the two powers. This is in Anguttara 2. And then it says, well, what are these powers? What do they do? And the Patisankhana bala, the power of reflection, is used to abandon the three types of misconduct, which is bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and misconduct by mind. Right? So the way to abandon any lack of virtue, any defilements, any personal defects, is through reflection. It is not through meditation practice or through deep samadhi, because at that point you have already abandoned them, you're already beyond those things. But to get there, reflection is really the way to abandon these things. And then, once you have gotten to that point, then you use the power of development to develop the samadhi and the bhujangas to get a high state of stillness in the mind, to enable you to penetrate and the Dhamma, understand and attain the wisdom of the Buddha. But in the meantime, what we really have to use to get to the point where the mind is pure, we have to use reflection, right? Contemplation. It's not about sitting back and just closing our eyes and meditating, watching the breath. We have to actively pursue the purification of the mind. How can I overcome anger? Well, the way to do that is to reflect wisely on the world around you, to reflect wisely on the people around you. How can I overcome desire for things in the world, attachments for the thing in the world? Again, it's about how we reflect about these things that really matters. And these are some of the very important things. And sometimes the reflections are very simple. There's nothing very fancy about them. But we just have to do them over and over and over. And as we do that, these things start to die down. And eventually, the hindrances, these things that weaken the mind and weaken wisdom, they disappear also as a consequence of that. So a large part of getting rid of the hindrances is just using reflection wisely. And the very last bit of getting rid of the hindrances is done through satipatthana practice, through mindfulness of breathing, etc., etc. Why is that? Because when you're watching the breath, you're not feeding any hindrances. You're watching the breath for the hindrances to remain in existence. They have to be fed, right? You have to think thoughts that give rise to attachment and desire. When you're watching the breath, you're not doing that. So it kind of fades away after a while. Sometimes when you sit peacefully for long periods of time, the mind can become very pure, but it has to have achieved a very high degree of purity beforehand for that to actually work out. Eddie, yeah.
Letting go of desires,
yeah,
is the hardest thing to do.
Yeah.
Don't okay. You think letting go of desires, Ajahn Brahmani, is the hardest thing to do?
Sure. It is not, it is not so hard. It's just that it takes a lot of commitment and perseverance.
Yeah.
And you have to keep on at it, right? Mm-hmm. That is what it really is about. But everybody can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just thinking, last night you were saying, you're saying, like in your practice, you want to come to a state where you feel there's conflict and there's depression, like you feel depressed. So, you know, desire, sometimes, I was just thinking, middle way, slow that down. Sure. What do you think?
Well, certainly, if you try to suppress all your natural feelings, this kind of thing, and try to push them out, then you might end up getting depressed. That's true. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of be a natural thing. You use your wisdom, and when you use your wisdom, they tend to die away by themselves. No force is required. That is the best way to do it. Yeah.
Thank you.
So, definitely. Yes, and in the front here.
In the modern world, cognitive behavioral therapy, interpersonal therapy, all that has to play first, and to get rid of these three hindrances, and then only you can meditate.
Therapy, is that what you're saying here?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think what you mean by reflections is cognitive behavioral therapy and interpersonal therapy, like trying to change yourself every day.
Okay. I don't really have that in mind. That can be useful. It can be useful, especially if you have certain kind of psychological imbalances, that kind of thing. It can be useful. But it's much more basic than that. These are kind of the very basic drives of human beings that normally nobody would go to a psychiatrist and say, oh, I like my food too much. What can I do about it? You know, the psychiatrist will think you're crazy. You know, go back home and enjoy your food. That's what they would probably say here. So this is much more basic than that. It is much more kind of the ability to detach a little bit from the world and to stand back a little bit. It's a much more profound thing here. So I agree, that can be useful, but at a more basic level, and then at a more profound level, we have to also use that kind of rational mind. So I think there are very few psychotherapists that are kind of there to take you into samadhi, right? And kind of going to guide you into samadhi. I think that's pretty rare to find those kind of... It would be cool if I had that kind of psychiatrist. Okay, so it is all about using the mind wisely, and using the mind wisely, reflecting in the right way. That is really how we kind of do all the initial groundwork on the Buddhist path. And once we have done that, once those things that weaken the mind have gotten out of the way, then it says here, the mind is established. It is well established. Suppatitta citta. In the four applications of mindfulness. It is well established because when there are no hindrances there, then watching the breath, doing satipatthana practice is easy. There's nothing really to distract you. There's nothing to take your mind away in one direction or another direction. You can focus on the breath with ease, right? It is well established on the breath. And the meditation happens naturally and easy. And you tend to feel the joys and the happinesses and all of these kind of things which are meant to be there on the Buddhist path. So it is well established. And because it is well established in this way, the mindfulness of breathing happens naturally, then of course the stages of samadhi, the stages of awakening here, I talked about here, they also happen naturally. The piti comes, the piti sambodhanga, right? The rapture, the happiness in the mind. The pasaddi, the calm of the mind, happens automatically. Then the samadhi comes, and eventually the upeka comes. All of the seven factors of awakening tend to arise as a consequence because of that. According to reality, it says here, so in the properly, not in a some, you know, the, all the way to the very end, to the fourth jhana, or whatever that is. So that is the way to awakening, right? Ending with the upeka sambodhanga, which is probably equivalent to the fourth jhana, the factor of awakening, which is the equanimity of the mind. This idea of upeka as one of the factors of awakening is also quite interesting. On the one hand, it means that the mind has a kind of a balance, the mind is balanced. But precisely because the mind is balanced, it has this equanimity, is often translated as, or maybe it can be translated as even-mindedness or whatever. Because it has a very profound sense of balance, it means that you are able to look on things without actually being distracted, without being kind of thrown by difficult things, without losing your balance when you see something that is hard to accept. Remember, what we're trying to see here are some of the most difficult things to see by insight, according to the Buddhist teachings. We're trying to see things like non-self. We're trying to understand suffering in its deepest sense. And of course, to see these things deeply can be quite shocking initially, because you're seeing something you're not used to. Whenever we do things that we're not used to, it is hard. It is, you know, it is perhaps a little bit scary even. It shouldn't be scary because it's all about happiness. But still, it is scary because we're challenging ourselves. So to enable us to do that, we have to have a mind which is very powerful and even and neutral and very balanced. And so that upeka also has this meaning of looking on. You're just looking on. You're standing back. You're seeing things as they actually are, without being thrown by it, without being moved by these things, and being able to take in even the most difficult realities of life. That is what this really means. And that is why this is the path to awakening, right? At this point, you're ready for even the Buddha insight of them, being able to make the breakthrough without having a teacher yourself, which is, of course, much more difficult. So, he knows this is the only way to awakening. This is how everybody gets there. And that is what he tells the Buddha. And the Buddha obviously agrees. And that is this beautiful little meeting between the Buddha and Venerable Sariputta. Okay, so everybody happy with that? Yeah, a lot of nice Dhamma in this little passage. So let us move on to the next one. So then what happens next is the following. Then, while staying at Nalanda in Parvarika's mango grove, the Lord gave many Dhamma discourses to the monks. This is morality. This is samadhi. This is wisdom. When stillness is imbued with morality, it is a great fruit and great benefit. When wisdom is imbued with stillness, it is a great benefit and fruit. When the mind is imbued with wisdom, it leads to the ending of the asavas, corruptions of the mind, the corruption of sensuality, the corruption of existence, and the corruption of ignorance. That is what has been abbreviated there in the translation. So again, the same thing again. And then, having stayed at Nalanda as long as he wished, the Lord said to Ananda, "Let us go to Pataligama," and they did so. So this is the next destination on this tour. We're now moving north. We started out in Rajagaha, which is quite south in the Republic of Magadha, and now we're moving north towards the river Ganges. The river Ganges, and then eventually, of course, they cross the river Ganges and continue north beyond that. Have many people here been to India before? Many people been to India? Yes. Okay, so quite a few, right? So you have a rough idea of what the geography of India is like. And of course, this Pataligama, which is mentioned here, is actually a very interesting city in many ways, because Pataligama, and today is called Patna. It is on the banks of the river Ganges. It is at the point where the river is enormous. When you go across the river Ganges by car or by truck, it is about 2 or 3 kilometers wide. Right? It's really, really enormous. You're kind of on this bridge forever, it seems, and you come across. It's a really enormous, enormous thing. One of the great rivers of the world, right? The river Ganges. Patna today is a big city, and it existed already at the time of the Buddha. At that time, it was called Pataligama. And it's very interesting, the story of this little town. At this time, Pataligama literally means the village of Patali. Gama means village, right? So in those days, it would have been a very tiny little place. In fact, so small that the Buddha never stopped there before this very last occasion when he went there on his last trip towards his final passing away. It is not mentioned anywhere else in the suttas that the Buddha actually visited Pataligama. This is the first time he went to this place. So maybe only now was it big enough to really be relevant for the Buddha's wandering around in India at that time. So it's a small little place, right? And what is so fascinating about this is that if you then go forward in history about 150 years, no, not that far at all, about 100 years after the Buddha's passing away, there are historical descriptions of Pataliputta, which it is known then. And 100 years after the Buddha, the descriptions of the city are the descriptions of this magnificent capital of this vast empire in the north of India. It is described in a couple of different places. One of the places is described is in the writing of an Greek ambassador to the capital of India at that time, and his Greek ambassador was called Megasthenes. And Megasthenes was the envoy of, I think his name was Seleucus II or something like that. He was a Greek king of what was then Persia, because just before this time, actually. No, this is not before, it was after this time. Get these things right. Now we're getting the sequence right here. This was after, that's right, after the conquest of Alexander the Great, right? So after Alexander the Great had walked through all of Asia Minor, through what is today Persia and Iran, all the way into India, that whole territory was kind of ruled by Greek kings after that. And one of the kings was called Seleucus I or II or whatever, and he was based in Persia. And he had an ambassador in India that he sent to India. His name was Megasthenes. And Megasthenes, being Greek, this was all part of Greek culture, they were very keen on history and on writing things down. So he wrote down all his experiences in Patalibutta. And those experiences were then, that book was then later on quoted by all the famous Roman historians. Rome too had all these famous historians, Arian and whatever they're called. And they're quoted there. In the present day, you can read about some of those things that Megasthenes had to say about Patalibutta. And of course, what he has to say about it is this magnificent city that was about, I think, 3 by 2 kilometers, surrounded by this enormous wooden fence, which has about several hundred towers on it, right, where people would then stand guard to ensure that nobody kind of attacked the city or whatever. With this, how many entrances were there to the city? A large number of entrances and gates, right, where there were guards on all sides and this kind of thing here. And he said this was by far the most magnificent city in India at that time. That's what Megasthenes has to say about this place. And Megasthenes, he was the ambassador to King Chandragupta of India. Chandragupta was the first king of the Mauryan dynasty. His grandson was Ashoka, so he was the grandfather of Ashoka. So you can see here, history is starting to show us what was happening at the time in India. And of course, what is very fascinating here is that 100 years before that, at the time of the Buddha's passing away, this was no more than a tiny fishing village on the Ganges. 100 years later, it is one of the great cities of the world, right? Probably rivaling some of the really great cities in Europe at the time. Athens, Rome, or whatever they were, or Alexandria, or whatever it was in those days. So it was a really magnificent place. And that transformation happened, right, in that short span of 100 years from the Buddha's passing away until the historical figure that we know about very clearly, Megasthenes. And what is, of course, interesting about this is that sometimes when you read the suttas, you're kind of not entirely sure how historically accurate are they. Is it really history that is preserved here? Is it, have people been exaggerating, or what is actually going on? But here we can see that the idea of Patalibutta actually fits in very naturally with the historical development of India. 100 years later, it is this massive capital. We know the Buddha died around 400 BC, and 100 years of development would seem, I would say it seems actually quite short, going from a fishing village to a magnificent city. But we can see how that development could have happened maybe over 100 years. And in fact, one of the things that we will see later on in this Mahapanibbana Sutta is precisely that they're already starting to fortify it, to build it up as the Buddha is passing through it. So we see the beginning of this development. And in fact, we also see later on the Buddha making a prediction about the future of Patalibutta, saying it would be called Pataliputta. It will be the center of all the Aryan kingdom. It will be the biggest city in that area. So the Buddha is like making a prediction. I don't think the Buddha actually made a prediction. What I think happened is that later on, when the editors made this text, they are very likely to have thought that the Buddha made that prediction and added those things in there. And that is how I expect these things actually happen, because the Buddha doesn't really make predictions anywhere in the suttas. So I would say it's probably a later addition, and that maybe thought wrongly, I would say, that the Buddha had said these things, and so it was added to the sutta. But you can see all of these things point to the fact that Patalibutta is in the process of growing, in the process of being established as the capital of the Magadhan Empire. And 100 years later, it is the capital of this vast empire going across all of North India, and it is one of the magnificent cities of the world. And what the reason I'm saying all this thing is not because I like a little bit of history, of course, I guess everybody does. But it's not so much that. It's more that it gives you a sense of the authenticity of these texts. They fit into history here, where, you know, the few kind of historical pointers that we have, the few places of cross-intersection between history and the suttas, it actually turns out that they are very accurately describing the India of the day. And this gives me again a very strong degree of confidence that these are real texts, right? They're actually recording real events. They're recording a person who existed in those days. And those teachings are not only recorded, but they are recording accurately because the history fits. If the history fits, then those things who are the teachings, who would have been far more important for the people of the day, they would have been recorded even more accurately than the history. So it gives you a very strong sense of confidence that these are real things. There is no kind of messing, very little messing around with these texts. They did the very best to preserve them as they actually are. If you think about it, you know, the Ashoka, he became the king of the north of India maybe 150 years after the Buddha. And of course, he was very important to Buddhism because he was a very strong patron of Buddhism. He supported the Buddhist cause to a very large extent, helped it to spread around all of India, to the north, to the south, to Sri Lanka, right, among other things. That was King Ashoka who was spearheading all of these moves around the known world at that time. And because Buddhists were kind of very proud of this, you know, the greatest king that ever lived in India, he was a Buddhist, for goodness sake. Of course, as a Buddhist, you feel, wow, that's pretty cool. But the interesting thing is, even though later on the Buddhists were obviously very preoccupied with Ashoka, and they wrote large books about Ashoka, the Ashoka Avadana, which is all about the life of Ashoka and how he arose and all these kind of things, even though these things became very, very important later on, it would have been very easy for the Buddhists to co-opt that grandeur of the Magadhan Empire, the greatest emperor who ever existed in India, co-opt that into the teachings to make the teachings of the Dhamma look even more glorious and profound. But they didn't do that. There is no mention anywhere in the early suttas about Ashoka. They didn't say anything about these things. They left it out. And that despite the fact of it having such potentially being so powerful and so important for Buddhism down the line. And again, this gives me this feeling that these things have been preserved with great care. There was very little willingness to change what was in the suttas because they had been told by the Buddha beforehand, these are the teachings you should preserve. If you preserve them in the right way, they will be for the happiness and benefit for a large number of generations in the future. We've got to preserve these things. We should be careful. We should be conservative. And that is what they actually were. They were conservative. And that is why the history in the suttas actually fits very well with what we know about a rough historical date of the Buddha himself. And to me, this is interesting. Later on in the same sutta, towards the very end, when they come to Kushinara and the Buddha is about to pass away, Kushinara at that time was just this tiny little place in the jungle far away. And Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, Master or Lord, why do you want to pass away in this tiny little village and in the backwoods, in the middle of nowhere, this kind of redneck town, right? It's almost like that feeling you get when you read about it. Why pass away here? You should pass away in one of the great cities of India. What were the great cities? The great cities were Savatthi, right? Capital of Kosala Empire. Rajagaha, capital of Magadha. Champa, the capital of the Angan country, which was to the east of Magadha. Kosambi, the capital of Vangsa country. Saketa, which were one of the other great cities of Kosala, and Vesali, which was the capital of the Vajrayans. These were the great cities. No mention anywhere about Pataliputra or anything like that. The great cities were found completely different places. So again, it fits right with the way that history actually worked out later on. The very interesting as well is when you look at some of the archaeological excavations that have been done in India, there's only one of these great cities that were excavated properly, and that was Kosambi. And when you look at that, it's actually a fairly small city. They look at the city walls, the city, the ramparts that went around the city, protecting the city. And it probably had no more than a few thousand, maybe a few tens of thousands of people. And these were the great cities at the time. They were relatively small. They were not kind of grand in any particular sense. So again, it kind of brings home what is going on here, and it fits very, very well with how we read the suttas and how all of this actually works. So just to give you a little bit of of background there, because I personally find it interesting. I hope you find it interesting as well. Otherwise, you are welcome to snore away a little bit while I talk about these things. So, yes.
I suppose the Buddha has been, during his teaching tours, has been very strategic, right? He stays as the really the metropolitan city of that time, right? Rajagaha-Sawati, right? And that's, in my limited understanding, that is about like New York or London at that time.
In a way, yeah. It was one of the big cities, but it was small by comparison to modern cities.
During that year. Then he chose to pass away at a small little town. What's the significance?
That's an interesting point. Why did he pass away at a small town? Maybe we should wait till we get to that point. When we come to Kusinara, maybe we can talk about it then. But maybe he was just nice to kind of pass away in a peaceful way rather than having thousands of people coming to see him. Maybe that was one of the reasons. Or I like to relax when I pass away. Maybe, right? I don't know. I guess the Buddha, just like everybody else, wants to kind of be able to, you know, to kind of, especially when you're going to die, it's kind of nice to sort of not having too many people. Maybe he just being humble, you know, why go to the great kings at the time? Maybe it was a way of being neutral about the relics, because the relics afterwards had to be divided. If he passed away in Savatthi, then the king there might take all the relics, right, and kind of keep them for himself. Being in a small place might have made it easier for the relics to be distributed evenly, perhaps. Another thing is that King Pasenadi, it seems, passed away before the Buddha, so it may have been he didn't really have any friends in Savatthi anymore. That maybe Savatthi was kind of turned a little bit against the Buddha at that time. So maybe the king there wasn't so friendly with him anymore. That's another possibility. Right, yeah, exactly. So that is another possibility. So there are a few possibilities like that. Minna, yeah.
You mentioned earlier that there was a prediction that Pataliputra would become a big city one day. And you mentioned that that's quite rare that the Buddha makes predictions, and that it could have been a later addition. Is there a parallel to that in Chinese texts as well?
There is. There are some parallels, and I think the prediction is pretty much the same. So it would have come in at a very early stage, if anything. So it is, you know, there are some fair grounds to think that it is quite original. But it's just my personal feeling, I think. It's my personal bias. That I don't believe in this, you know, so much in these kind of things. Ah, Ananda, you come back from the retreat as well. Okay. Lenny, yeah.
The question that, asked about why Buddha decided to go to Kusinara, is there a story? I think I read it in the Great Disciples of the Buddha that he said that in a previous life, he was the great king in that massive city that it was, though it is a small place. Probably he was showing how the impermanence works as well, that it was a great city, the Kusinara.
And that
he was the great king in that city. Was there a story?
There is indeed. It's called the Mahasudassana Sutta in the Pali Canon. It's the sutta after the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. In certain versions of this sutta, those two suttas are actually conjoined into one. And the Mahasudassana forms a large subsection of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. It does. But when you read that sutta, you get this feeling. This is we're getting into legend territory, mythology, right? This is no longer history as such. So it could be that legend came about precisely because people felt so embarrassed. Why does the Buddha pass away in Kusinara, right? This small little place. But he's a Buddha. He does things differently. He doesn't do things according to worldly standards, right? He's not interested in praise and all these kind of things. So he does things in a kind of low-key way. To me, that's quite inspiring. Why does the Buddha have to pass away in this magnificent city here? But I think later Buddhists felt that. So then this legend may have come about. But when you read that story, it is absolutely really, really over the top, right? It's absolutely, it's kind of nice, but it's really, really over the top at the same time. So I wouldn't kind of, so did he die there because it was a big city in the past? I don't know. It doesn't really have. I'm not sure about that, possibly. But anyway, thanks for bringing it up because it is a good point. Ainsley,
Is this Pataligama the place where we have the one recorded miracle which the Buddha made?
One recorded miracle that the Buddha made. Well, I think this prediction maybe is a bit of a miracle, but I. Oh yes, yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, thank you. That's exactly right. We're coming to that later on because it's part of this sutta as well. And this is where he stands on one bank of the river Ganges, and then he appears on the other side with the entire Bhikkhu Sangha, and he says a verse of it. While all these other people are striving and struggling across, those who have insight, they have already passed, or something like that.
Thank you, Arjun.
Yeah.
One more small point. He spoke to Sariputta in Nalanda. That was probably the last time the two of them spoke. Would that be right?
Yes, that would be right. Yeah.
This must be a very long, extended tour, because aren't we told that Sariputta died before the Buddha?
Yes, yeah.
So implies that the tour which the Buddha was on must have lasted a year.
Oh, definitely, because remember, after he leaves Pataliputra or Pataligama at this time, then he goes to the north side of the river Ganges, then he walks on to Vesali, and he stays for the rains retreat, right, in Vesali. So that's 3 months there, and then he continues after Vesali to walk on. So it's probably about 6 months from here until eventually he passes away, something like that. So there would have been enough time for Venerable Sariputta to pass away in the meantime as well. Yeah, indeed. So. I'm not sure, but
he died in the same year.
Yeah, so I think he may have been older than the Buddha. You see,
I thought so.
So quite possibly, yeah. But I'm not entirely sure about that. I'm not sure if the history about these things is all that reliable. So uncertain.
He was certain that he died at the age of 80.
Certain within, you know, reasonably certain. There's some little bit of evidence for that. There's a few verses that says that he left the home life when he was 29. He practiced, but those verses themselves are not the most original things. The verses themselves are probably fairly late, you know. So, plus minus a few years. But certainly, he says, you know, things like towards the end of his life, his body was falling apart and his skin was getting wrinkled and all of these kind of things that you would expect when you get very old. So, bad bags, all these kind of things. So he obviously was getting very old at that stage. Yeah. Anybody else want to ask anything? I think we're coming to the end of this of today. Yeah. Unless we should go on for another couple of hours. I'm not ready for that. I think. So everybody happy? Yeah. Okay. Great. So let's stop there and let us continue. Next time. So if you are excited by the sutta, please come next time. No idea when that will be. It might even be after the rains retreat, but it will happen eventually. Great. Okay, let's pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha.